There we are. Hey, good evening, everyone. John Henry Soto here, along with George Batista. Welcome to Counterparts, where we spotlight conversations with creative minds, and not just creative minds, but influential and inspiring minds. Like today or tonight, we're going to have Bobby Watts on the show. He is the CEO for the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, based right here out of Nashville, Tennessee, and we're very, very excited to have him on the show. We're going to be talking about a lot of inspiring things, his life and his journey and the journey of so many people that work with him. It's going to be really, really awesome conversation. So please hang tight. All righty, welcome back. Awesome. So as I mentioned, Bobby Watts is our guest this evening. We're going to be talking a lot of things. And he's from New York. So you know we're going to be talking New York because we got three New Yorkers here. So look out, world. We're gonna do some stuff today. So George, I want to hand it over to you. And let's do some love to our sponsor.
Okay. So first and foremost, the Counterpart Show is brought to you by Wellness Resources, a family-owned and operated nutritional supplement company providing the highest quality clinically formulated supplements since 1985. Find out why Wellness Resources is the top choice for health-conscious individuals around the world. Make sure you go to myvitaminresource.com. And if you enter the promo code Counterparts, you will get free shipping on all orders.
Cool.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about our guest today. So today we have Mr. Bobby Watts. Now, Bobby Watts is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, which supports the 300 federally funded healthcare for the homeless programs and 100 medical respite providers with training, technical assistance, sharing the best practices, research, publications, and an active policy and advocacy program working to eliminate homelessness. He has served on numerous boards, government-appointed task forces, and work groups, including serving as the finance officer for the New York City HIV Health and Human Services Planning Council. Bobby brings with him 30 years of experience in administration, direct service, and implementation of homeless health services to the community. And we are absolutely delighted to have him on this program. So ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bobby Watts.
Woo!
All right.
All right. Thank you so much for being on, Bobby. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, thank you. And George, I'm going to try to bring you along whenever I need an introduction. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah,
he's gotten really good at that. It's, that's why he does it, because I tend to stutter. but we want to thank you for being on. We know that you're from New York, and that's always an exciting thing for me and for us, because we've lived the life. We're also probably all similar in age around, and we remember what New York was and what it's become, and it's gotten so much better, obviously, and it's the improvements have been tremendous. And so it's just exciting to have us here. Now, here we are, you know, having this conversation and all coming from that area, which is really cool. So it's great. I'm excited about it.
Absolutely.
I'm glad to be here. I've watched a few of your shows, and I really love the chemistry between the two of you. The lightness, the fun, as well as the serious conversation. So I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. Yeah, you know, we're cousins, so we've known each other a very long time. I've known George, you know, when he was shorter than me.
Right.
I mean, you can imagine that.
Yeah, so. That didn't take too long to, you know.
Yeah. It was a good 5 years I had. But I wanted to start off. George has like official questions. He's like Mr. Organized when it comes to the questions. I like to kind of free flow a little bit, but so I'm going to turn it over to George so you can ask our first question, and then we're going to rock and roll.
Yeah. So for one of the first things I like to do, especially when we have a guest on, I like to learn a little bit about them, learn about them growing up, you know, and eventually how they got into what they're doing. And, you know, your mission is absolutely, you know, amazing and what you're doing here. So, but tell us a little bit about growing up in New York and then eventually kind of like what led you to your current mission.
Yeah, thank you. And though I am known far and wide as a New Yorker, I really was born in North Carolina.
Okay.
Right. Old enough to have been born in Gaston County Negro Hospital under Jim Crow. And my parents separated when I was very young. And my mom brought my two older sisters and me to New York. And one of my first memories was waking up on a couch in my aunt's house in the Bronx, because we were doubled up. My mom, you know, she was getting situated. And then when I was about 5 years old, we moved to Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And that's where that's really where I grew up, in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Okay. And this was when it was the bad old days.
Yeah,
it was always going to be gentrifying, and it took about 20, 30 years before it really did. But that was, I was long gone by then. And fortunately, my mom lived in the same apartment that I grew up in for about 50 years. And I would bring my kids. They were born and raised in the Bronx. We'd come back to visit, and they'd say, Dad, how come we can't live here? And I would just have to say, we can't afford it. It was really, really nice. But growing up, it was the pretty much the gang capital of New York.
Right.
And I was very fortunate in that my mom was a teacher. So going to public school, I always was aware that though it was a poor neighborhood, I was aware that I was not poor, that we were better off than those who were living in the projects or in tenements. And for whatever reason, that always stuck with me. And I realized it was pretty much just an accident of birth, not because I was smarter or better.
Right.
Yeah, and it wasn't until I left my neighborhood to go to high school in Manhattan that I realized, you know, we're pretty far down. And then I went to college in upstate New York. I realized we were really, really far down.
Yeah.
But fortunately, it never got to why don't I have as much as other people? It was why do people have so much while other people don't have their basic needs met? Great. So for whatever reason, that's always been my mentality. And that really was a bridge into caring about the poor, and which was one of the reasons why I got into this work.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you mentioned how you knew, you understood that you weren't poor or as poor as those that were around. And I had the same kind of thing because my grandparents, you know, they worked, they were, you know, they were almost retired, but my grandfather was still working when I was born, but he retired a few years later. We always had food. There was always, you know, we always had clothing. It was, you know, that part outside things were going insane, but inside there was the stability that we had there. And I think that's the same viewpoint that I took, was like, you know, I'm very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just very lucky that I was born here. These are my grandparents. This is my mom. And these are my siblings. And we're all like where we love each other. And we kind of had a little cocoon of safety, you know, that we were able to, all get out. And, you know, and by get out, I don't want to say get out like in a negative way, but we were all able to expand in what we wanted to do and to help others. So that's awesome. When you went to, do you remember the moment? Because it's always like, I remember the moment when I wanted to play guitar, for instance, or the moment where I wanted to do something. Do you remember the moment where you said, I need to help?
Yeah. Well, there's several ways to answer that question. So I always was sensitive, and I don't even, you know, as a kid, we didn't grow up in a religious household. And for Christmas, I just remember telling my mom, don't give me any Christmas presents. It's not my birthday. Let's send this to, you know, some poor kid overseas or whatever. So that was always my, I mean, I got Christmas presents. But I would also say that. And then when I was, in college, really became engaged in social activism, you know, on campus and in the town. There were two poor communities, and I did volunteer work one summer in one. Actually, it was paid at a community center in one side, and then the next year the other. So I was really engaged in the town as well as on the campus, and that was like a refuge. The town was like a refuge for me. College life is like an artificial life. Everybody is young. Everybody is smart. Everybody is pretty kind of sheltered from the real world of struggle while they're in this 4 years being taken care of by their parents, many of them. So that really helped ground me in even during those years in needing to be involved in communities.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, George. I'll just keep talking.
We know.
And I will too.
Yeah. Do you find it that had you not done those volunteer or those paid, help positions, do you think it would have been different? Because it's really difficult for college kids that are in, like you said, they're in this kind of bubble. And the world is coming through or their phones today, right? The world is on the phone, and whichever side you're looking at, it may be skewed in one way, skewed in another way. So there's really not a lot to experience. You decided to go experience it.
Yeah, like I said, it was like a lifeline for me. When I went to school, I went there what I would refuse to let my kids do. I went there sight unseen. So I grew up in Brooklyn, tall trees, used to ride in the subway to high school in Manhattan, hanging out in Times Square, da 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 da. And this is a beautiful place, Ithaca, New York, beautiful. But it was, for me, it was culture shock. I didn't realize till many years later that what I was experiencing was culture shock. And, my neighborhood was primarily Latinx, which in that time meant almost exclusively Puerto Rican, right, and some African American, some Asian, and some white, but primarily Puerto Rican and Black. And then went to campus, which was a predominantly white institution. And like, where's the buildings? Right. Where's the concrete sidewalks? Right. And where are the Black people? Yeah. So got involved through a roundabout way in a local Black church downtown, and then got involved with the community. And they just really took me under their wings. They were just very nurturing of all of the Black students. They were, though it was in upstate New York, it really was like a piece of down south, because that's where most of the people had migrated from. And really just really took me in, for which I'm forever grateful. But it helped me, because being involved in campus activism and, the struggle, it was kind of theoretical in the sense of you're just thinking about students. And I really felt when I was working with the Black churches, seeing what their struggles were, and that helped me to see, no, this can't just be theory. It has to be grounded in reality and what ordinary people's lives. And so working at the two community health centers with the kids was very, very helpful for me.
Yeah. Awareness level is huge. And it seems like your awareness level at a young age was pretty high. So
I was actually going to mention that, because you think about it, kids, a good majority of kids growing up, they don't have that awareness of even giving back, right? Because a lot of the kids are like, take, that type of thing. When you even said about the Christmas gifts and stuff like that, and, I don't need Christmas gifts. I mean, it's something you don't hear a lot of, right? But at the same time, there's something in you that's saying, I need to help, I need to give, I need to, and it really is an amazing thing. Like I said, that you really don't see a lot of, and I mean, it's something that I admire in it, because some people just you just have that within you.
Yeah. And so it's not something I can claim credit for. Right. It's like, so I'm just very grateful that I had that mentality, and not like, oh, I want to have what they have.
Right. Why
do they have more than I could have been natural, but I'm grateful that it didn't, because it's being grateful is a really important attribute for having a happy life.
Sure.
Being content with what you have instead of desiring more is more important than having more. Yeah. Because if that's your goal, having more, you'll never be satisfied.
Exactly. Right. And funny enough, when you have that viewpoint, you actually end up getting exactly what you need. And because of that, you're not desiring for more and more and more. But it is an interesting thing, the awareness level. And I'm not shy to say, George and I did have early on very high awareness of where we were. We just knew. I would look around and see buildings burning and all the other stuff, and I was like, well, this isn't normal. We had presidents visit us and all the other stuff that was going on. The one of the things that I remember where I was, I would say, you know, not to say pride, but just that I was happy that I made this decision was when I was about 11 years old. I remember a friend of mine who was 12, and he was the only guy who could go outside of the fence of this little corridor that we had. He went outside this thing. And I remember one day I'm hanging out in this little corridor and I hear, and he's in a car and he's driving a car. He's 12 years old. And I'm like, I'm like in the bars. I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, come on. And immediately I said, no way. You know what I mean? Like I would never, but some other guys did, right. You know? And I just, from that moment on, I just realized, okay, there's a way you can go. And there's another way you can go, you know, there's the, and I didn't know the difference between, all I knew is that that one made me uncomfortable, you know, and that instinct, that awareness is really what saved, in my opinion, all of us, God, you know, obviously, but really we have that in us that we were able to see, I ain't going that way. So that's pretty scary. And yeah. I think George could attest to some of those crazy, you know, environments.
Definitely.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about Williamsburg.
Yeah.
You know, there was, you know, I have friends that live in, you know, they live in Williamsburg now, you know, and it's really nice and they got these great places. But no, you know, when you were there, there was definitely no man buns. There was no organic, there was no organic anything.
Correct.
You did have Puerto Ricans, so you had great food.
Yes, I did.
You know, but. When you were there, did you ever feel like you were in danger?
Oh my goodness! I mean, when I would take my kids on a tour of the old neighborhood, this is where they stole my bike. This is where they held me up in gun park. Oh, this is where they robbed me of my jacket.
Oh wow!
So, you know, you learn to be. You know, I was. I'm average size now, but I was always short until you know, like. Late high school. Right. So learn to be streetwise and So I mean there were unfortunately because it was a lot of gangs, especially on the south side of Williamsburg, there were shootings in my IS 318 where I went to what we call junior high school, 6th to 8th grade, IS 318. There were a kid who was killed in the playground, caught between gunfire between gangs. So, having said that, there were times you felt danger around you, but I never felt like super scared because, again,
Bobby's frozen. He froze, Bobby.
Are you guys there? Okay. Was Mitchell Llama housing, which you may know, it's a New York City thing. Mm-hmm. So it's subsidized housing for lower middle income people. Mm-hmm. So it was a large complex and that kept the gangs out because it was just too too many for them to come in.
Right.
And I didn't realize later, you know, it's subsidized, so it was only a certain percentage of our income, and that gave my mom the freedom to invest in us in other ways, take us to art classes and music classes and things like that. So I didn't understand it completely, but I understand now. I had an unfair advantage of my friends who weren't living there to school with me. But I knew I had it better off than they did. And that was always a concern.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. Talk about your present work and how, like when it started, your work with the homeless, how did that start?
Yeah. So let me just say, we had a lot of crime in New York, mm-hmm. I mean, in Williamsburg, and poverty. What we did not have when I was growing up there was homelessness. Mm-hmm. So later when I would go visit my mom, you know, it was really posh and so forth, but the same subway stop I would take to school, you know, to high school and come back, there were homeless people sleeping there, even though the area had become wealthier and New York had become wealthier.
Right.
So being aware of rising homelessness and just that fact that, again, we have so much in this country and some people don't have the basic necessities. I decided before starting graduate school in public health that I was going to defer for a year to be a living counselor at a rescue mission. And that's what I did. It was in Lower Manhattan. Now they changed the name. It was actually the first rescue mission in the country. Now they changed the name to New York City Rescue Mission. And so I lived there for what's going to be 1 year, but it ended up being 2 years. And the guys there were, this was when crack was just starting. The epidemic was just starting. Mm-hmm. And so I saw the demographics of the guys there. It was a men's rescue mission just for men. Change before my eyes in the 2 years from maybe about 70-75% older white alcoholics to being about 50-50 that crowd, but then young black and Latinx men coming in with where it was crack. Mm-hmm. And many of them were ones that I played basketball with on the playground, went to school with, and some of them were coming straight out of prison and they didn't have a place to stay, so they would come. So it just reinforced to me, I met some guys who, one guy was born in prison, and other kids, you know, came through the foster care system. And it just really emphasized to me what I knew in my head and knew that we all don't have an equal shot in life. Mm-hmm. Some of us are born with advantages that others aren't, or born with disadvantages that others aren't. And it just saw how important it was that we try to meet the basic needs of people. Right. And, you know, and this was a rescue mission, so there was a spiritual dimension to it, as well as feeding people, giving them clothes, giving them counseling, helping them find jobs. I loved it there. And the guys really took me, the older guys took me under their wing the first week there. They said, come with us on the street. And I got to see what their life was like, going from place to place to get food, and how they were treated, and trying to find a place to, when it was raining, to stay dry while they're outside. Mm-hmm. And that really, they really took me under their wing in ways they didn't have to. And I learned a lot there that I still count on today.
Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing. And, you know, that environment also is one that's, you know, it's, I feel like there were a lot of us were failed in school because we weren't educated in certain elements of survival, certain like drug, like right now we had a guy on a couple of weeks ago, his name is Bobby Wiggins, and he worked with the drugfreeworld.org. And he's done almost a million presentations to a million kids, like across the world, actually international. Mm-hmm. And just amazing. And a lot of the young kids really just didn't know until this presentation was given to them what certain drugs do, you know, they lead to other things. And it, because it's always, for me anyway, it's always been that's been the problem. I experienced homelessness for about a year, and I was in a shelter, and I did the welfare hotel kind of thing, you know, with my family, you know, so it was like we were together, but it was so bad, you know. We had all our stuff stolen, like we had to go out. When we came back, everything was gone, like all our clothes. So it was really, really, the struggle was there. But the one thing that we did have was we were educated. My mother, who also was a teacher for a little while at our Catholic school, was always telling us about drugs, stay away, this is what it does, this is what, you know. So I've never smoked a cigarette, I've never done anything in anywhere, just because I was so terrified of it growing up, which is, because then you get to see the results of it, you know. Can you talk a little bit about that, as far as like how it actually, when you were there during those years, you know, how much of that is rehabilitation money goes into that, is, you know, even more than trying to get housing?
Wow, that's a hard question. So let me see if I understand it. So I'm going to probably have to turn it around answer it in a different way than you think I'm going to answer it, or that than you answer. So one of the things is, while there are life control, substance use disorder is a life controlling condition, and can really affect you. There are many people who have substance use disorders that are housed. Correct. There are many people who have, and actually the majority of people.
Right, right. Well, I was going to say most of them
are. Yeah, and the majority of people with severe, you know, with mental illness are housed. So the difference is, when someone is experiencing homelessness and they have that condition, the defining thing is that they don't have housing and they don't have services to get them into housing. Right. So we don't, as a country, we don't provide enough mental health services, substance use disorder services. We certainly don't provide enough housing for people, even though it is well within our means as a country to do that, if we so chose, but we have chosen not to. So yes, I want to focus on people who need help to get out of it, out of substance use disorders. If they so, you know, most everybody I know, unless they are highly functioning substance use abuser, wants to get out. But it's very hard, especially if you don't have the right services. And we know that one size doesn't fit all. At the rescue mission, that was, you know, abstinence. We just want you to stop. Period. Right. Some people that works, and God bless them, and I'm thankful for that. And some people through, you know, have a spiritual renewal and they can just stop. I know many people that have. Most people don't. And so we want to have a full array of services that can help them. Now we know, especially with opioid addiction, medication-assisted treatment is extremely effective in helping control the addiction and helping people come off of and stop using the substances as they want to. So we spend a lot more money than we should in criminalizing what is really, in my point of view, in most public health people's point of view, medical people's point of view, a medical condition. We understand it as a medical condition. Now, it's not just a matter of willpower, though that there is a part of that that's necessary to overcome addiction. But it is, we spend a lot more criminalizing it, locking people up, both for mental illness and for a substance use disorder. And actually the highest, where you're gonna find most people, most with mental illness in New York City, is in Rikers Island, because they're not getting the treatment that they need, and it gets criminalized, their behavior. So we're not spending nearly enough on rehabilitation, on recovery, or treatment.
Yeah, and that was great. You answered exactly what I I know the way I asked it, I sometimes but it really is, it's amazing to me. This is still a very prosperous country. And we definitely have the means, as you mentioned. And it's not, you're right, it's not just the willpower. I mean, it is mental. There's the gentleman that we had on talked also about how some of these drugs lodge into the fatty tissues of your cells. So when you can actually, even if you're off of it for a month, something can turn on and re-stimulate something. And you know, so it is a heavy thing. You know, so that much I definitely do know. But in your what do you think is needed as far as trying to raise the awareness of that we need more funding? You know, we're sending a lot of money. I won't say the P word, but I want to get into the, but we, you know, we're sending money to a lot of other places and putting them into a lot of other things that really, when you look at it, can actually handle millions of people, could house millions of people. You know what I mean? We've gone over that, you know, numerous times. And so what's your thought on it? What's the one thing that you think people really need to understand and to know about?
Wow. One thing.
Or two.
Okay, good.
give him a break, John.
But I'm still thinking, what is the P thing?
I'll give you two.
George,
I'll give you two.
I don't want you to say it, but George, do you know what the P thing is? Okay, all right. So I'm gonna try to figure it out.
Knowing this man for 50 years,
I think you know the ones that we vote for. Those
people. Yes.
Okay. Oh, okay, sure.
Yes.
Got it.
Say the P word.
Okay. So
the P word.
you know, I think most people are not aware of how little we spend on housing for the poor to meet their basic human needs compared to how much we subsidize housing for the wealthy, for the more well off in the term of private home ownership. Mm-hmm. So I spoke out in Orange County, one of the richest counties in California, richest counties in the country, once. And I started by saying how many grew up in subsidized housing. I said, I found out I did, you know, Mitchell Mama Housing in New York, No one else raised their hand. And then I went on to explain how we subsidize private home ownership in this country. So, you know, Benjamin Franklin said a penny saved is a penny earned. Another way to look at it is I'm going to let you keep a penny that you should pay me. Then that's a penny I've given you that I don't have anymore. So through the tax code, people who have private homes can write off their interest deduction. They can write off the interest. Right. They can deduct that from their taxes. That does almost nothing to help get a roof over people's heads. What it really means is whether you're going to get a bigger house or a smaller house, but not whether you're going to get a house or not. We spend about HUD's budget is about $50 billion, which is to support public housing projects, public housing authority, you know, projects, Section 8 vouchers, and other ways of making housing affordable for poor people. Right now, only one out of four households that qualifies for the federal standard, for the federal requirement of being, receives any help because we don't fund it enough. So you qualify for, you meet the federal guideline, which is pretty low, but we only give subsidy for one out of four people. Meanwhile, which is a human need, you got to have that house.
Right.
You know, if you don't believe the housing is a human right, which we do at the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council do, the housing and healthcare are human rights. You have to admit this is a human need. But at the same time, we spend in the most recent estimate I've seen, and this is after the tax cuts of 2017, which reduced the amount that you can write off in your interest for your home. We're subsidizing about $250 billion for private home ownership.
Wow.
So the wealthier you are, or the bigger the house you get, you know, up to that limit, the more subsidy you're getting. So that's money that should be coming into the public coffers to be used for the general welfare that's going to home for those who are privately owning homes. So at the end of my talk there in Orange County, I said, now how many people grew up in subsidized housing? And they realized, and several people came up to me and said, I never realized that. I never thought about it. I don't need that. That didn't have any effect on me.
Wow.
So if we subsidize housing for the poor, just by transferring, it would be more just, it would be more equitable, and we wouldn't have people on the streets of our nation. We wouldn't have children sleeping in cars, sleeping in welfare hotels. They would be stable. John, you mentioned how stable your home was, your family was. Mm-hmm. I know how stable mine was just because my mom didn't have to worry about making rent because it was subsidized. I didn't know that at the time, but it made a huge difference compared to my classmates who were living in tenements, around us, who were precariously housed.
Mm.
So if the one or two things would be how little we give to subsidize the basic human need for those who are poor in the richest country on earth, and how much we give to those who are much wealthier for them to own a home when they don't really need it.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, they don't need the help.
Right. Right.
Exactly.
I mean, you're lucky you weren't escorted out in Orange County. You know? Mr. Watts, can you?
They asked me back three times. So I've been there four times now. So.
That's awesome. But yeah, those are the kind of things that's education.
Right.
I mean, this is where something like this is really important. Like, we'll take this section of you actually saying this and we'll blast it out so people can actually have that information, because it's just something that just people did not know. I didn't know that, and I think a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. You know, do you feel? I'm sorry, George. I'll let you.
Oh, thanks, John. I appreciate it.
I forgot you were.
I forgot I was here.
I forgot you came. I forgot you came today.
I showed up.
I thought you were on PTO.
Kind of piggybacking though on your story in Orange County, and just kind of something more personal for me, because I, you know, a few years ago prior to the pandemic, I went to LA. It was the first time I had gone to LA, and I guess I never really understood the issue there with homelessness until you're actually driving through the freeway and you're seeing the tent cities and you're seeing, you know, you're coming out of the airport. I mean, just it's all, and I was completely shocked. My whole family was shocked. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of hear it in the back of your mind, you know, in the background, but you don't really understand it until you're actually seeing it. So, and then from what I understand, and I look after that, I had kind of looked at some of the numbers and stuff, and I know, you know, what they're saying is, like, you know, let's say 2007, 2008, it wasn't as bad. Then, like, maybe in when it got to like 2015, 16, it just skyrocketed. And of course, the pandemic did a whole nother job on that. But there was this notion, there's this fight, I guess you can call it, and going, you know, not talking about the P word, but people who do make these policies and things regarding, well, should we make the housing, should the housing be the first thing? Or should the, you know, should the help on the, you know, rehabilitation side be the first thing? Okay. And there's, you know, some that say, well, no, if you make the housing, in the housing, then you can figure out everything later. And then, of course, this back and forth. So I was just wondering on your concept, you know, on that.
Sure. Issue. Yeah. You know, and these are things I wish I had known 30 years ago when I was living at the Rescue Mission. But Dr. Samson Burris, about 30 years ago in New York City, created an organization, Pathways to Housing. Mm-hmm. And he is a psychologist, and he got very frustrated when back then, and it still is, many people have the idea, you have to show you are housing ready by meeting this criteria, right, to show that you are ready.
Right.
And so many people were falling short. You know, they may collect 3, 4, 5 steps, but don't get to step number 10. And then they're back, you know. He said, you know, why don't we just try putting people in housing, mm-hmm, and get them stabilized and bring the services to them? It's a housing first movement.
Right.
There have been many studies, peer-reviewed journals. It shows to be effective for many, many people. Mm-hmm. Again, you need to have many tools in your tool chest, but mm-hmm, this is an approach that is extremely effective. And it's found out even when services aren't required, when people are stabilized, then they're more likely to ask for the substance use treatment, mm-hmm, or be compliant with their medications, or meeting their appointments with their mental health psychiatrist or counselor, right, and so forth. So I believe for many, many people, housing first, mm-hmm, not housing only, it's, mm-hmm, housing first, okay, combined with services, right, is extremely effective. And okay, there are guys that, you know, at the mission, we're trying to get them ready, show that you're ready. There's so many steps there that it was almost impossible for the average person to succeed. And so I think, yes, let's get them stable. And we've seen this in the COVID pandemic.
Right.
For the first time, many cities, states said, to protect the health of people experiencing homelessness, let's get them out of crowded shelters. Let's get them out of encampments, especially those who are medically frail or susceptible to COVID or have COVID. And let's put them in hotel rooms, or in California, they also use RVs.
Right.
And many people, they got stabilized, they got healthier. Many people then got back on their feet. I do, one of the things why this is new to you, George, when you went to see LA,
mm-hmm,
New York is a shelter, is a right to shelter city.
Mm-hmm.
So based on two court consent decrees in the 70s. Homeless single adults and homeless families have a right to shelter in New York. So you see very few, relatively speaking, people on the streets of New York. Now, it's changed in the 5 years since I've been here in Nashville. But still, the vast majority, like 95% of people experiencing homelessness, are in shelters, not on the streets. And it's much different in many cities in the rest of the country, including LA. Okay. So people don't necessarily, no one wants a, many people don't want a shelter on their corner, but they much rather have a shelter than have an encampment or something where people are living out in the open, where they're where they don't have a place where they can go to the bathroom, where they don't have a place where they can wash their clothes, where they don't have a place where their garbage is going to be picked up. So, I can go on and on, but
No, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, it's also a dignity. This is why they do well. You know, it's like someone now they have their self-respect, their dignity. They actually have a place that they can call their own. You know, then they can really focus. I mean, man, I can't imagine being an adult. I mean, I was 16 years old when it happened to me, and I had adults that cared for me, and I felt protected. So, but an adult that really has no place, and suddenly you do, you do have a place. You know, there's such a improvement in spirituality and your dignity, and you just feel like, okay, now I can actually look, I can focus on what I need to get done and take responsibility for this, because this huge, giant ordeal of not having a roof is gone now. Yeah. You know, it's like that to me is like a really, really important thing.
Yeah. I mean, homelessness is deadly. It's bad for one's health. It kills prematurely. Yeah. It makes it harder to take care of any medical condition. It's much harder to take care of if someone is unhoused than if they're stably housed. And we don't talk about it much, but the trauma and the stress of being out on the streets or even in a crowded shelter is a lot. Not having a door that you can lock behind yourself. When all of us go home, first thing we do, we go in and we close the door, and we usually, especially if you lived in the Bronx or Brooklyn, or you lock the door behind you.
Couple of locks.
Yes, a couple. Right. But you don't have that option. So if you're living out in the streets, if you're living in an encampment, if even if you're living in a crowded shelter, you know, in a congregate shelter, not all of them are crowded. So that does tremendous harm to your body, the constant stress. Sleep deprivation is a huge problem among people experiencing homelessness. And want to remind people that sleep deprivation is a form of torture according to the Geneva Convention. So we people experiencing homelessness, when we don't get sleep, research shows we don't make good decisions. We're irritable, we're cranky, our judgment is slowed and flawed, and that's the constant state of people who aren't getting regular meals, don't have a place where they can necessarily store their things safely, know that they, you know, they can sleep in a park bench without getting rousted and moved in the middle of the night. And then we have all these other issues. But we've shown that when we put people stably housed, even for like a 6 months or a year in the COVID pandemic, it makes a big difference in people's lives. Because I'm not used to encampments, you know, being in New York where we didn't have a lot, and my former agency did do street medicine. We're the first one in New York City to do street medicine, but there still was, most people were in the shelters. Here in Tennessee, it's the opposite, or at least in Nashville, it's the opposite. Most people are out in encampments and the woods and the parks. So I do volunteer and go there. And I stopped for about a year and a half during the first part of COVID. And when I went back, so many of the people I would see week after week, month after month in encampments were now under the COVID programs in housing. So we would visit them, take them clothes and food. And we found, oh, yes, I got my paperwork together. I got my work papers together now. I'm in treatment. Some of them went back to work. Because of the stability of having a home. And these are some people, if you had asked them, do you want to go into housing? Their thinking is shelter. Right. And they didn't want to go into a shelter. Right. Some people are, and I thank God for shelters. I worked in a rescue mission, a congregate living facility. My former agency operated a women's shelter. But many people didn't want it. And they could not conceive that they could have a place where they could lock a door behind them. But when they were given that, they took it. So when most people, even people say, no, I'd rather be outside than I don't want shelter. I don't want housing. When you show them what we take for granted, just the very basic, it could be there were 8 guys in one house, but they each had a room that they could lock behind them. And they shared, you know, the kitchen and the bathroom and so forth. And they were happy, but they never could have conceived that that's what was available to them before.
It's interesting because I was watching a documentary on this, and they were interviewing a lot of, you know, a lot of those folks, and such a majority of them had one. It was really just one incident that happened. There was a divorce, or there was a, you know, something that happened. They lost their house for whatever reason. They lost their job or whatever it is, and never imagined that they would be in that situation.
Right.
There was one young lady who had a child that was a victim of domestic violence. And she said, I'm going to be homeless because I'm not going to raise my child in this environment. And she, you know, and you see this, and these are some of the stories that sometimes you don't hear because you just think, oh, there's a homeless person. You know, people think, oh, they're just homeless. They don't really want to do, but there's so much that goes behind that people really don't see.
I wanted to, I'm sorry, did you want to respond to that?
No, I agree.
I wanted to also, we're at almost 46 minutes, time flies. Whoosh. But you also, you raised 3 boys, and, you know, George and I are fathers. And, you know, one of the things that is, you know, what we're asking for advice. We have young kids, but how did you convey to your children? Because our kids are having a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My kids have no idea. You know, they're concerned about their Robux and getting on their computers and things, which is fine, you know. And I want them to but I also want them to understand that this is, you know, they're the product of struggles and a lot of social work and a lot of a commitment from family to that where they are right now. What was your, you know, your conversations with your sons?
Well, wow. I don't know if they're listening and if they'll agree, but you know, really wanted them to understand how privileged we are. And, you know, fortunately, you know, my wife and I made some conscious decisions. I refused to leave New York, you know, the city, and moved to the suburbs. I you know, stayed in the Bronx. And that was on purpose because especially doing the work I wanted them to understand and to be, as well as get the benefits of growing up in New York and being exposed to. I mean, I'm so grateful I did, and I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to raise them there. But we made some conscious choices. Basically every church we joined had a homeless ministry and outreach. So they got to see it not as charity, but these are our brothers and sisters. So when our youngest one was 6 months old, we were attending a church on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and we were attend what they call the homeless service in the evening, on Sunday evening. And people would take them from us and we wouldn't see them. They'd pass them around, because how often would someone trust your child? Would they be trusted? But we knew they were completely safe. And, you know, their Sunday school teacher at one point was sleeping under plastic in a bench at, by the boathouse on, 79th Street. So they got to see that, as well as my work. So our neighborhood was a working class neighborhood in the Northeast Bronx. But when we first moved there, like on our corner was like drug bazaar. And, you know, we got to talk about what that was. But mostly just to let them know how blessed we were not just compared to kids in this country, but our kids in the world. So we would always talk about what the conditions are with, you know, in other countries and other nations, and pray for them. And when my kids, you know, one of the first things kids say is, it's not fair, you know, da da da. It's not fair. I say, yeah, you're right. You're right. It's not fair that you get to walk over there and turn on the sink and get a glass of water, and some kid in another country has to walk 2 miles to carry water back, back to his family. No, it's not fair. You're right. So, you know, for whatever reason, like I said, I was always aware how much I had, and I wanted to pass that on to them of just how much they had. And they got to see that, you know. Fortunately, both my wife and I were college graduates, and not all of the kids in our neighborhood or in our church were. So they got to really see how fortunate they were, and hopefully take that lesson with them. And I think they have. Our oldest son works for college and runs a program for inner city kids in Chicago. And he said, my dad's in public health and my mom's a social worker. I'm destined to never make a lot of money. Yeah. but he's very happy. He does very worthwhile
stuff. Of course. That's awesome. That's great. Thank you for that. And by the way, you know, I am blessed that I was born and raised in New York. I love New York. I know that it was whatever it was, but like George and I remember George, we were driving into New York once from, we were going over the Brooklyn Bridge. You remember that one day we were in the car, we were going to like a rehearsal or something, and we played in a band. And we just remember like crossing the Brooklyn Bridge and that view and just making a joke. It's like, we made it, you know, we live here, right? But yeah. We're like yelling, we made it, we made it in New York, you know, because it was, it's such a beautiful place. So yeah, definitely. Even though we had those experiences, we were blessed that we were there, and blessed that we were able to also help others that were there and are continuing to do that. So one of the things that we do at, you know, we always ask our guests, during the last 2 years, it's been tremendously difficult and challenging for many people across the world. Some people are out there, some people are still afraid, some, you know, they're still kind of like just kind of getting out. What advice or words of wisdom would you give to someone out there that's actually in a moment right now where they're not sure exactly what the future holds for them?
Wow, you told me you were going to ask me that question. That's a really hard question, a good question, because you can attack it from so many angles.
Right.
I'm going to say that I think it's really important that we look to stay connected to someone. One of the biggest problems in the pandemic was people were... some of their connections were torn or severed. And we are social beings. You know, we're made to be in connection with other people. And I think that is so important to reestablish that, you know, if it can be electronically, the more it can be in person where you feel safe, that's even better. But the main thing is not to stay alone, not to be alone. And almost no matter what you're going through, someone else is going through it too, or has gone through it already. So, you know, I remember what one minister said to me. He said, you know, we can get through anything as long as we're not going through it alone. Mm. And I've found that to be true. So really urge people to maintain that human connection. It's actually, you know, it's a human connection, but it also can... not just help our emotions, but it also is a spiritual connection to other people that we don't want to overlook in this pandemic or any situation. It's really, really important to cultivate friendships and maintain them. One elderly person to me many years ago, and I still remember, said a friend is like a jewel. You never want to throw it away. And the longer you have it, the more precious it becomes to you. So maintain those friendships. You mentioned you guys been friends for us a long time. I was in my apartment building where I grew up, my best friend, we called each other brothers. We were just talking. We've been friends for 50 years. Willie Mercado, former New York City policeman, and now living out in Las Vegas and working. But we just realized how fortunate we are to be have someone, you know, be friends for 50 years.
Yeah, definitely. But thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. Awesome. So we're almost approaching an hour. I can't believe it. We'd love to have you back someday, and we'll talk more because we actually we also didn't cover the respite program that you also are the CEO, which I think is also an amazing program as well. Maybe we can set something up in the future and talk about that because that's also fantastic. Bobby Watts, thank you so much. Appreciate you taking the time. And we love it. Thank you.
It's an honor. Thank you, George. Thank you, John.
All right. Thank you. Bobby Watts. Wow. I told
great,
you, man.
Great conversation. What a cool guy, too.
I know. And he's like, he's so on point.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, yes. He just has the data. He has the information. He's lived it for so long that he knows, you know, so every question was just like nailed, you know. So I mean, that to me is really inspirational.
Wonderful.
And growing up in that environment. And by the way, he said he was, you know, born I think North Carolina, I think. But once you're in New York for more than 10 years,
you're in New York, no matter what, doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, wherever you were born, it's no longer a thing. You know, it's like you're in New York, Bobby. Sorry.
Yes.
All right. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We appreciate y'all very much. We will see you all again next week, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. George Batista, John Henry Soto, counterparts, thank you very much. Have a wonderful week ahead. And as always, peace.